rockets land near an oil field in a military facility housing U.S. forces in Syria. Palestine denounces international silence in the face of Israeli settlement plans, evictions, demolitions, and seizures of Palestinian property. And Europeans angered by lockdowns and vaccine mandates occupy the streets in several countries. Don Behrouz, it's a great pleasure to have you with us. A U.S. military base comes under a rocket attack in Syria's eastern province of Deir al-Zor. According to local sources, multiple rockets were fired at the Al-Omar oil field overnight. The field is home to one of the U.S. military bases in Syria. No word on any possible casualties. The attack reportedly caused fires that were contained by American troops on the ground. The U.S. forces then hit back at the location from which the rockets had been launched. American drones also began flying over the oil field following the strike. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry has lashed out at the international community for remaining tight-lipped in the face of Israeli atrocities. In a statement, the minister said that violence over Israeli settlement activities and Judaization process in Al-Quds are an utter disregard for the two-state solution. It says the settlement projects are basically concentrated in and around East Al-Quds and will eventually lead to the isolation of Palestinian neighborhoods there. Meantime, Israeli forces have arrested some 100 Palestinians in anti-occupation rallies in the Negev region. Anti-Israel demonstrations began in Negev 4 days ago and were marked by an Israeli crackdown on protesters. Now, we've talked to a Palestinian scientist and author, Mazen Kamsiya, and he tells us why there has never been a two-state solution to begin with. Let's take a listen.
Well, there was never a plan for a future Palestinian state. A two-state solution, so-called, is not a solution. It's a delusion, and it's an illusion that was instituted by Ben-Gurion in the 1920s, and since then he and his descendants have used this idea of talking to Palestinians about the two-state situation, but not really implementing it, and the facts on the ground show it. And in any case, there's never a colonial, anti-colonial struggle that ends in a two-state solution.
Now, another weekend and yet another round of protests against vaccination and COVID curbs in Europe, and that amid a surge of infections fueled by the Omicron variant. Now, in France, thousands hit the streets of capital Paris to slam President Macron's COVID policies. They're angry at a new government plan to further restrict the unvaccinated. Once approved by the Senate, the bill will require everyone above 12 to show vaccine passes to enter public places. In the Austrian capital Vienna, thousands rallied against mandatory vaccination for all that's due to start next month. People in Germany and Italy also came out to protest new curbs. They said that the measures violate their freedom.
On Saturday, Rome, Milan and Naples, Italy's largest cities, saw protesters railing against the vaccine passports that are now required to access much of public life. The largest demonstration was held in the Italian capital, Rome, where over 5,000 people gathered in iconic St. John's Square to express their anger at the Mario Draghi government's latest COVID restrictions. The new law has expanded the scope of the National Health Pass, which now can only be obtained through vaccination or recovery from the infection. Italy's public transport, restaurants, hotels, museums, gyms and leisure places are required to check the pass before providing their services to the citizens.
We are not against the vaccine. My daughters and I have been vaccinated. Furthermore, we don't hold it against the Italian fellow citizens who got vaccinated. It was their choice and we respect it. We are sick and tired of being considered just numbers for statistics. We are human beings, citizens, with our rights and freedoms.
The organizers of the protest say they are not supporting the no-vax movement, but are very concerned over the socio-economic consequences of the restrictions. Thousands of small and medium-sized companies that make up the bulk of the Italian economy have been forced to shut down due to the coronavirus lockdowns.
Tutto il popolo degli imprenditori.
Retailers, shopkeepers, everybody knows full well that the new restrictions will hit them even harder. Scientific experts have explained that the vaccine offers partial protection against transmission or of infection from the virus. This green pass is just a way to control us.
Despite Italy recording over 180,000 COVID-related cases on Saturday, the daily number of reported coronavirus infections in Italy has begun to fall in recent days. However, scientific experts say the Omicron wave has not peaked just yet.
On top of the pandemic's socio-economic effects, Italy is bracing for the upcoming presidential election. Lawmakers will elect the country's next president on January 24, with current Prime Minister Mario Draghi among the contenders. The possibility of a government crisis cannot be ruled out. Max Civili, Rome.
Guatemalan border guards have blocked the crossing of the first caravan of Central American migrants to head from Honduras toward the U.S. this year. Authorities say that clashes broke out as hundreds of people try to go through the Isabel border crossing. There were around 100 unauthorized crossings. The caravan consists of Honduran and Nicaraguan migrants. They set off on their journey on Saturday. Central America and the Caribbean have seen mass migrations toward the U.S. amid economic hardship worsened by the COVID pandemic. The caravans frequently face crackdown as migrants attempt to cross borders of the regional countries. Now in the U.S. state of Texas, all people taken hostage at a synagogue are now free and unharmed after police killed the captor.
Sometime around 9 p.m. today, this evening, the HRT, the hostage rescue team, breached the synagogue. They rescued the three hostages, and the subject is deceased.
Well, that 10 hours after a man disrupted religious service and began a stand-up with police in a small town called Colleyville. The suspect's identity is not known yet. Local reporters said that they heard the sounds of explosions and gunfire shortly before the hostages were set free. The suspect apparently demanded the release of a convicted terrorist. Time now for the news review. Prospects of reconciliation between the U.S. and Russia over Ukraine remain bleak following bilateral talks in Geneva. The U.S. is now threatening Russia with a swift response if it invades Ukraine. Senior U.S. diplomat Victoria Nuland says that the U.S. plans to inflict very sharp pain on Russia should it attack Ukraine. She says that the U.S. has prepared 18 scenarios in the event of a Russian attack on Ukraine. She says, however, Washington is still open to dialogue with Moscow and intends to respond to its demand for security guarantees. On the other side, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov says Moscow and Washington are on totally different tracks. He says this is disturbing for Russia. The remarks follow meetings between Russian officials and the U.S. and NATO earlier this week. The West accuses Russia of planning to attack Ukraine. Moscow rejects the allegation outright. Now, inviting a couple of guests now to get some more insight on this. Jerome Hughes, our correspondent in Brussels, is joining us. Also, Markis Papadopoulos, historian, public analyst, and author in London. Now, let's go to Brussels first. Jerome, diplomacy has apparently failed. The two sides are, you know, keeping up their harsh rhetoric, as you know. So given the fact that they're very far from reaching an agreement, so how seriously should we take the threat of a new conflict erupting in Europe?
Well, Behrouz, it's difficult to say. Diplomacy has failed so far, but certainly we haven't reached the end game yet. And, you know, just in the past half an hour, I was speaking to one of my contacts in the European Commission, a senior official there, And the European Commission, its job is to formulate policy in terms of building up sort of a sanctions package, a potential new sanctions package that would be applied against Moscow. And they're coordinating closely with London and also Washington to try and build up this potential package of sanctions. And what I'm told is that, you know, in the event that Russia invades Ukraine, which of course Moscow denies that's the intention, well then these sanctions would be applied, and apparently they would be the strongest sort of sanctions package that have ever been put together. They would be sort of targeting sort of all aspects of Russian society, Russian citizens living abroad, and the idea would be, you know, apart from a financial impact on Vladimir Putin, that it would have a political impact on him. But really what I'm also told is that what's most likely to happen at this stage is that the West is going to give assurances to the Kremlin to say, look, you know, there are no immediate plans for Ukraine to join NATO. We'll scale back our military operations close to your borders and on the Black Sea, and to just give concrete assurances to Vladimir Putin that, you know, this is going to de-escalate from the Western side. Because really the feeling is that there's no military option here. I mean, if you leave the nuclear weapons aside, even on a conventional war footing, Russia has an enormous military capabilities. It has a fantastic defense system right along its borders in terms of anti-missile system. It has a huge number of troops. It has state-of-the-art equipment. And so even the feeling is that, you know, NATO officials feel that there's not even really a conventional war option with Russia, apart from the fact that it has this huge arsenal. Again, of course, always in the background is the possibility of it escalating to nuclear, which would, of course, be catastrophic. So the only show in town here, Behrouz, according to the people I've been speaking to, is a situation of diplomacy and to try and scale things back. And of course, they will be asking for Russia to try and give something in return. The elephant in the room, of course, is Crimea. I mean, I was speaking to one analyst recently, and he said, look, you know, perhaps if you're going to criticize Vladimir Putin and his government, you could say that maybe they rushed into Crimea a bit too quickly, because the 2014 referendum, there was the overwhelming majority of the people of Crimea wanted to rejoin the Russian Federation. So perhaps he should have played the long game with that. Mm-hmm. That's a game he would have won in the long term. Perhaps he did that too quickly, perhaps without coordinating better with Kiev and with Brussels and with Washington and so on. And that continues to be sort of a major bone of contention. And it's sort of the backdrop to all of this.
All right. Okay, now let me ask Marcus this. Marcus, one basic argument that Russia is making is that NATO promised to stop enlarging beyond this what is called Cold War area, but then those promises were broken, as you know. And NATO is arguing that it's decisions made by consensus, not by promises made by individual member states, alluding to the United States, do not count as the alliance's formal policy. So which side do you believe is giving a more plausible argument?
There are two words which account for the dangerous level of global tension today between America and Russia: NATO expansion. And there are two words which account for NATO expansion: American exceptionalism. It is indeed the case, the irrefutable case, that in 1990, the Soviet Union consented to German reunification on the grounds that NATO would not expand beyond Germany's eastern border, namely into Eastern Europe. That was an assurance, albeit a verbal one, which was given to the then Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev by George Bush Sr., Helmut Kohl, Francois Mitterrand, and also the then American Secretary of State, James Baker, who told Gorbachev that there will not be one inch eastwards of NATO expansion. But, alas, the Americans violated that oral assurance which was given to Mikhail Gorbachev, and that is why NATO expanded not just into Eastern Europe, but also into the Baltic states of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. So Russia has a legitimate grievance, but time is not on the side of the Russians, because whilst American policymakers are saying that they are prepared to keep on discussing the crisis surrounding Ukraine with the Kremlin, at the same time, the Americans are arming to the teeth the Ukrainian armed forces. They are expanding NATO's presence in Eastern Europe and also in the Baltic states. The Americans are widening their naval presence in the Black Sea. And on top of that, Washington is encouraging Sweden and Finland to join NATO. So you see, the Americans are demonstrating their specialism in duplicity. In public, they are calling for further dialogue with Russia, but at the same time, they are going to extreme lengths to undermine and threaten Russian national security. So what are Russia's options? Well, it is possible that Russia could take military action of some kind in Ukraine to counter the very dangerous presence, the very dangerous menace emanating from the country against Russian national security. At the same time, the Russians could deploy military personnel and hardware to Cuba and Venezuela. Indeed, in my new book, Arise Russia, which was published about a year ago, I predicted that the Kremlin would deploy or would consider deploying its armed forces to both Cuba and Venezuela as a bargaining chip to be used against the Americans in relation to the American military presence in Eastern Europe. And whilst NATO on paper is a collective decision-making bloc, in practice, America is the de facto leader. Right. When America wants something, NATO does it. Because quite simply, the Germans, the French, the Italians, the Greeks, the Spanish are very concerned about NATO's presence in Ukraine, and they do not wish to see Ukraine admitted into the Western military bloc. So all is not well in NATO.
Right. Okay. I'm sorry to jump in. That's all the time we have. Thank you very much. Jerome Hughes, our correspondent in Brussels, and Marcus Lepidopoulos, historian, public analyst, and author in London. And that's it for this edition of the News Review.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Martyr Soleimani will live on forever and his enemies will disappear in history's dustbin, January 5th, 2022.
Praise be to God, Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master, Muhammad, and his pure household, particularly the remnant of God on earth.
رحمت خدا رضوان خدا بر شهید عزیزمون که ماجرای شهادت این عزیز بزرگوار یک حادثه ملی بلکه یک حادثه بین الملل اسلامی شد و خب دومین سالگرد هست مردم دارن این کارها رو میکنن.
May God's mercy and paradise be bestowed upon our dear martyr, whose martyrdom turned into a national and international matter in the world of Islam. Well, this is the second anniversary for him, and people are doing many things in commemorating him. Later on, I will expand on the things people are doing. In fact, we are only following what the people are doing. Our meeting and our statements are actually a continuation of the innovative moves being made by the people throughout the country. I previously spoke of the Soleimani School of Thought. Shahid Soleimani turned into a school of thought, or it was so from the beginning. Praise God, I have seen that many books have been published about this school of thought, books that I hadn't seen before. If we want to briefly explain what we call the Soleimani School of Thought, we should say that it is summarized in truthfulness and sincerity.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
این دو کلمه در واقع عنوان و نماد و نمایه مکتب سلیمانی است. صدق یعنی همون چیزی که در آیه شریفه من المؤمنین رجال صدقوا ما عهد الله علیه که حالا مختصری توضیح عرض میکنم.
These two words are actually the title, symbol and emblems of Martyr Soleimani's school of thought. Truthfulness is what we can see in the holy verse of the Holy Quran. Of the believers are men who are true to the covenant which they made with Allah. The Holy Quran, Surah 33, verse 23. I will expand on this later. Sincerity, too, has been mentioned in numerous verses in the Quran, including, Say, verily I command that I should serve Allah, being sincere to Him in obedience. The Holy Quran, Surah 39, verse 11. These two verses from the Quran formed the basis of Martyr Soleimani's movement.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
At a press conference in Moscow, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov touched not only on negotiations with the West, but also the peacekeeping operation in Kazakhstan and the upcoming meeting of the presidents of Iran and Russia.
The visit, in short, is very important. It's time to resume contacts at the highest level, which are traditionally close and regular among us, and which also fell victim to the coronavirus infection. The significance of the visit, first of all, is the need to take an inventory of our entire agenda, taking into account considering the new government in Iran.
Lavrov added that Moscow is in favor of holding a conference on security in the Persian Gulf, where it would be possible to discuss the claims accumulated both by Iran against its Arab neighbors and by its Arab neighbors against the Islamic Republic.
Such forum can unite Iranians and Arabs. Each of the parties would put their concerns on the table. They would also talk about their concerns over Yemen, Syria, Iraq, and other volatile areas that somehow cause controversy between other countries.
Regarding relations with the West, Russia has come up with offers of security guarantees as its patience has run out. Moscow is waiting for the West to give a concrete and written answer to its initiative and is not going to wait indefinitely. Last month, Russia's foreign ministry published draft security proposals between Moscow and Washington on ensuring the security of Russia and NATO member states. Consultations on these issues were held on January 10th in Geneva, a session of the NATO-Russia Council was held on January 12th in Brussels, and a meeting of the OSCE Permanent Council took place on January 13th in Vienna.
The appearance of NATO on the Russian borders is categorically unacceptable. This is a real red line. The appearance of U.S. weapons and military bases there on the Sea of Azov is the second red line. It simply reflects the West's overreach, and to put it bluntly, in violation of all obligations, in violation of common sense.
Lavrov said NATO had come ever closer to Russia's borders during five waves of expansion starting 1997, when it formalized its relations with NATO. The diplomat said it absolutely cannot suit Russia when it is required to send troops to barracks on its territory, while at the same time the Americans, the Canadians and the British are building bases in Ukraine and the Black Sea region.
Russia's efforts to strengthen ties with its neighbors demonstrate differences between the CSTO and NATO. Russia and its allies leave countries at the end of military missions, thus establishing strategic partnerships. And regarding unfriendly policies adopted by Western governments towards Russia, Moscow advocates for constructive dialogue and mutual respect. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
India's Supreme Court has notified the northern state of Uttarakhand and New Delhi authorities to investigate the recent incidents of vicious hate speeches by several Hindu religious leaders, which called for Muslim genocide. The petitioner stated such incidents, if not addressed with the rule of law, pose a grave threat not just to the unity and integrity of the country, but also endanger the lives of millions of Muslim citizens. Activists call it encouraging move.
The Muslims of this country, when they decided to stay back and not migrate to Pakistan, the reason was that they believed in a system which is not based on any religion, which a constitution, an idea of India which is plural, which is diverse, which respects each and every citizen equally.
Since the partition of the subcontinent in 1947, Indian Muslims have been subjected to widespread discrimination, but it all swelled after the emergence of BJP in 2014. The community has been subjected to deliberate vicious hate campaigns and violence. Several Muslim organizations accuse the government of Prime Minister Modi of turning blind eye towards the issue.
Last few years have been overly violent, considering the growing hostility towards the community. Experts say this could tear apart social harmony in a diversified country which has a long-standing history of terrific communal violence.
Anti-Muslim sentiments have risen extensively. Since last few years, Hindu mobs have unleashed striking attacks on Muslims, lynched dozens of people, mainly Muslims and Dalits, accusing them of indistinct activities in addition to other systematic repression. Activists call it the pretext of a larger political agenda to turn India into a supremacist Hindu nation.
This is part of the larger design. I mean, it is not that they are doing it on their own. They know that they have state patronage. They have patronage from the political party, the BJP and the RSS. And so they are emboldened.
As India's state elections draw near, anti-Muslim rhetoric is flaring across the country, which experts call a political gimmick to polarize the community, therefore playing a divide-and-rule policy. Activists, however, maintain that resistance to the violent and divisive politics is also growing. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
This is the first time Hossein Amir Abdollahian visited China as Iran's foreign minister. The one-day trip came upon an invitation by his Chinese counterpart, Wang Yi. The visit marked the beginning of the implementation of the much-anticipated Sino-Iranian pact known as the 25-year strategic partnership.
In this trip, we agreed to start implementing the 25-year comprehensive strategic cooperation agreement. I also delivered a written message from our president to his Chinese counterpart, Mr. Xi, to implement the agreement.
The Sino-Iranian Comprehensive Strategic Partnership was announced in a joint statement during a visit by Chinese President Xi Jinping to Iran in 2016. In 2020, Wang Yi and then-Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif signed the pact in Tehran. So far, no detailed information has been revealed from the agreement, but the two sides say it covers economic, political, and security areas.
During today's meeting, we talked about industrial, scientific, technological, and economic areas, as well as tourism and other subjects that are covered by the 25-year agreement.
During the talks, China also reiterated its support for Iran's nuclear rights in the ongoing Vienna talks, aimed at removing U.S. sanctions, which Washington reinstated against Iran in 2018, after it unilaterally left the 2015 deal. As signatories to the accord, China and Russia both urge Washington to remove the sanctions as the only path to rejoin the deal.
Today, we extensively discussed the Vienna talks over the removal of U.S. sanctions on Iran. China's representative in Vienna, along with his Russian counterpart, plays a positive part in advocating Iran's nuclear rights and the removal of the anti-Iran sanctions.
China is Iran's number one trade partner. This partnership heavily relies on Iran's oil supply to energy-hungry China. Reports show that in 2021, and despite U.S. oil embargoes on Iran, China tripled its oil imports from Iran. Now the implementation of the new pact will guarantee the flow of Iran's oil to China and cement the two sides' trade ties. It goes without saying that China and Iran are strategic partners in every sense. And the top Iranian diplomat's trip is a sign that Tehran is determined to keep that path with Beijing. The two sides are expected to engage even more as the 25-year strategic partnership has moved from paper to practice. Yusuf Jalali from the Chinese city of Wuxi.
If you want to keep warm this winter and can't afford to keep your heating on, wear an extra layer. Do star jumps or hug your pet for warmth, if you have one, that is. 3 of 10 recommendations from Britain's third largest energy supplier to British households. Some of the Britons we talked to had this to say in response.
Disgusting. Probably just like what most people think, to be fair. And if you're anybody like me who's suffering in a house with mold, damp, and excessive cold anyway, with uninsulated houses, then it's even 10 times worse, so
it's absolutely horrendous. Because, I mean, I saw something on the news the other day where one energy company was saying, you know, get yourself a pet to keep you warm. Did you see that? And all this sort of nonsense. I mean, how are people going to manage?
The company's founder has since apologized, but he also said this.
Globally, energy prices are going up, and we need a system that consumers pay the true cost of energy. There is no way to magically make that lower.
There may not be a magical way of pushing energy prices down, but there must be something the government can do to contain the situation, like a working energy strategy.
And the simplest way of doing it would actually be measure it according to income. So those who've got more wealth and the broadest shoulders should pay most, and those who can't afford to pay least and get protected by the rest of society. But at the moment, no one's doing anything.
With barely any rise in their income and faced with rising taxes, millions of British households are shaking at the prospect of a nearly 50% increase in their energy bills in spring.
Since October last year, the energy price cap set by industry regulator Ofgem has been at more than $1,700. That is expected to change in April by nearly $1,000 when Ofgem sets the new cap, resulting in British homeowners' energy bills rising significantly.
You're going to see pressure on the weakest this year, and that's what's so unfair. There'll be more discontent. Does it mean there'll be riots and things like that? No, but there'll probably be demonstrations of people concerned about the level of poverty.
While the British government drags its feet on dealing with the looming cost of living catastrophe caused by stalling wages and rising tax and energy bills, less fortunate Britons will have a tough winter to battle through, with or without a pet for warmth. Saeed Puriza, London.
Year-end data shows that 2021 saw a massive, deadly, and record worsening of the situation for asylum seekers trying to enter the United Kingdom from France. The size of the Calais refugee camp tripled to 30,000 people, even though camp demolitions occur almost daily and treatment is routinely denounced as inhumane. Nearly 30,000 refugees reached the United Kingdom last year, but at the cost of 1,000 people who became shipwrecked, resulting in at least 44 deaths. November saw almost 30 refugees drown in a single night, the deadliest such incident ever recorded in the English Channel. 3 years ago, Paris and London decided that France would close all routes to the UK, leaving dangerous sea crossings the only option.
What's become known as Fortress Europe has gotten better and better at organizing themselves to become even more harsh and even more deadly. The aim is to show the world's refugees, look at how badly you will be received. Don't come here anymore.
Late last month, a French NGO filed a manslaughter lawsuit against the coast guards of both France and the United Kingdom for allegedly ignoring the drowning boat's distress calls to the rescue services of both nations.
We're on a path which is incredible in how it is both lamentable and repeatable. Unless we do something immediately, such atrocities will continue. The European Union has allowed the Mediterranean Sea to become the biggest graveyard in the world. Must we make the English Channel a rival?
The vast majority of refugees in the world are caused by Western military interventions, often led by France and the UK, in places like Syria, Mali, Afghanistan, Libya, Iraq, and elsewhere. Politicians in both the UK and France, where a presidential election campaign is effectively underway, have been repeatedly accused of scapegoating immigrants in order to win over their domestic electorates, which lean heavily to the political right. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
...82% of the UK's population has been fully vaccinated against COVID-19. There is vaccine hesitancy in every community, but in some more than others. The proportion of unvaccinated people is roughly twice as high in South Asian people and four times as high among black people.
There's a long history of medical abuse in our communities. We have disproportionate impacts on medical interventions, be that sickle cell anemia, be that infant mortality in the first year of life. A whole range of conditions, vaccine hesitancy and scepticism is quite high in our community and has to be acknowledged. You can't berate people into doing the right thing.
Doctors have urged unvaccinated black and South Asian people to get their COVID jabs after new data revealed hospitalizations and deaths are higher in these groups. But there seems to be little appetite for it. More than 90% of all white people aged 50 to 54 have been vaccinated with a first dose. That compares with just 62% of those of Caribbean heritage.
To find out more, we've come to Brixton, a part of London that has a thriving Afro-Caribbean community.
But plenty of people that don't want to take it, they say they don't know what's in it. They said they don't know what's in it, and it makes some people sick. Because me, when I had it, I was off work for 2 months straight.
The community, they think Boris is just a player. He's not explaining exactly what he needs to do or what he's doing. And 1 week, he changed his mind. It's a game. He's playing a game. and people are not children.
A lot of people are not taking no vaccine now, you see. A lot. For me, my kids, no. My kids, they work in the hospital. So in the hospital, probably they will tell them to take something, I don't know. But for me, no.
The black community is more likely to live in a densely populated area, work in public-facing roles such as health and social care, and live in large and multi-generational households.
The pandemic should be seen as a magnifying lens that has amplified existing disadvantage and has made that acutely aggravated. So whatever was the problems before, black and ethnic minority youth unemployment has doubled during the pandemic. That we've seen the rate of mental ill health and breakdown within our community go off the charts.
Vaccine hesitancy is not unfounded. Historical medical experiments conducted on black people remain in their psyche, far outweighing their fear of COVID-19. So now they'd rather see the vaccines tested on the white people first. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Syrian President Bashar al-Assad met Iranian Minister of Roads and Urban Development Rustam Qasimi. During the meeting, the two sides discussed means of expanding bilateral cooperation in public and private sectors, as well as encouraging further joint investments. Assad underlined the importance of starting new projects that achieve strategic and joint benefits for the two states and link business sectors in Syria and Iran. Qasimi, for his part, renewed his country's support to Syria in fighting terrorism and assisting the Syrian people. The Iranian official also met with Syria's Foreign Minister Faisal al-Miqdad. They asserted determination to reach a significant level of trade exchange and economic partnerships.
I met today with President Assad. We discussed economic topics and agreed on forming a joint committee to remove all obstacles on the way of expansion of mutual ties. I also met with Syria's foreign minister. We agreed to set a plan for developing economic relations between the two countries and regional states.
We discussed economic relations. Nothing at all can block expansion of our economic relations. We discussed partnerships in the transport sector. Syria is interested in heading eastwards, as President Assad stressed back in 2005.
Qasimi also met with his Syrian counterpart and reached agreements on consolidating cooperation in the transport sector. The Iranian delegation's visit aims to further activate economic ties, mainly in the transport sector, increase the number of flights between both countries, as well as the bulk of trade exchange. Qasimi's visit comes following a similar one by Iran's Minister of Trade, Industry and Mine less than 2 months ago. Talks recently between both countries' officials have focused on establishing partnerships with the aim of boosting their economies together to counter economic sanctions imposed by their enemies. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
Ever since the Great Recession began, decreased purchasing power has been the number one complaint of French voters. Because one in four Frenchmen suffers from a serious housing problem, Emmanuel Macron made better and more housing a central plank of his 2017 presidential campaign. Today, inflation just hit record highs in France and across the Eurozone, and housing has become even more expensive during the coronavirus crisis.
A recent poll showed that 3 out of 4 French people feels that their purchasing power has diminished, and 90% of the country is concerned about it. While the elite may be able to afford these higher costs, it's clear that the rest of France is deeply concerned.
Top NGOs and some unions gathered in Paris to warn all candidates that recent years have seen untold socioeconomic damage, which could result in more political upheavals.
And this is the reason why these organizations have come together, to be able to raise a cry of alarm and try and intervene in the campaign.
Affordable housing has long established fixes. Write laws which favor tenants and not landlords. Put more tax revenue into building new housing and create more shelters for those with emergency needs. The Macron era has implemented none of these solutions, which has allowed the price of real estate to cross the records of 10,000 euros per square meter in Paris and 3,000 euros nationwide. Inflated or not, real estate must be heated in winter, and record energy prices has the government already admitting they are worried about the social fallout which soaring prices could cause, as in 2018 with the yellow vests.
In the election, socioeconomic questions will be very prevalent because inequalities have gotten so much worse in recent years. Households are either having major problems paying their bills or simply getting evicted. The current government has made no initiatives to remedy these problems, especially regarding housing.
Some believe that housing is for living in, and some believe that housing is for investment speculation. But in a French election dominated by right-wingers, the leading candidates will be forced to at least pay lip service to the idea of state-sponsored remedies to soaring prices.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his prophet progeny. Dear brothers and sisters all over the world, assalamu alaikum and welcome to yet another edition from series of Canon Islamic Beliefs from IRIB English Radio. As you have been following and listening such shows from IRIB English Radio, in this series of shows we are trying to talk about the questions and, let's say, the doubts and misconceptions that we are receiving from different questioners all around the world. For that, we have invited Islamic researcher and scholar Sheikh Nur Muhammad from Qom Seminary Schools to this show to help us to answer the questions. Before asking the first question, I'd like to welcome Sheikh to this show and say salam to him. Salam alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to this show.
Salam alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Many thanks for accepting the invitation. The question of the day is concerning a historical issue that was asked by a question. I want the respected guest speaker of the show, Sheikh Nur Muhammad, to actually answer this question in the best way possible. Sheikh, it has been asked that, is that true that Imam Ali alayhi salam proposed to the daughter of Abu Jahl? And was that a reason for Lady Fatima Salamullah alayha, for Lady Fatima Salamullah alayha's anger against Imam Ali? It means that she got angry with Imam Ali alayhi salam to propose to the daughter of Abu Jahl, and this event actually made her a little bit angry, and this was mentioned in history. I want you to exactly tell us what was the story and what and where from this doubt actually is rooted from.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You see that in the history, some people, because of the hatred towards Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, they attribute some lies for the Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. You see that these hatreds and animosity towards Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam caused a lot of fake narrations in the hadith corpus, and some of them is the particular narration that we are dealing with. In this narration, it has been quoted in Sahih Muslim and Sahih Bukhari that, for example, Imam Ali proposed for the daughter of Abu Jahl, and it was a reason for the wrath of the anger of the Lady Fatima. You see that it is the pure lie, I can say. Actually, there is without any shadow of doubt. And actually, it has, because if you check the chain of the narration, you see that the one of the narrator of that is Miswar ibn Makhrama. And actually, all narration in this regard, maybe we have some narration quoting this fake story, and the main chain person who actually quoted this narration and the made up this story is Misbar ibn Makhrama. If you look at the biography of this individual, he was one of the enemies of Imam Ali. He was lover of Muawiyah, and when the name of Muawiyah was pronounced publicly, he was sending rewards and salutation to Muawiyah.
Right.
Actually, this was famous for that.
Strange.
And this individual, Miswar, was one of the follower of Abdullah ibn Zubayr, mm-hmm. you see. And he was he has a close relationship with rebels and Khawarij. You see, he has a relationship with all enemies of Imam Ali alayhi salatu wa salam. And he was a follower of Muawiyah, rebels, and Abdullah ibn Zubayr. You see, in that, if you have this context of the narrator, you see this hatred toward Imam Ali caused a lot of fake narration against him,
mm-hmm.
and he wanted to cause trouble for the, for the upcoming generations. But it is obvious for everybody, and for the most scholars, they are familiar with the narrator, with the biography of the narrator of the narration. They can easily understand and check it out that this Miswar in the time of the demise of Noble Prophets, he was only 8 years old, mm-hmm. and he was a child. How 8 years old child can understand such a thing and the proposal to the,
yeah.
for example, daughter? You see, from all aspect and dimension, we understand this is a fake narration against Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam.
So, Shaykhana, such issues actually is a need of having a knowledge of Rijal, and the science of actually the knowledge or science of Rijal, which is the science of knowing the true and fake narrations from each other. So, for an ordinary person like me, how can I distinguish between these different narrations if I don't have access, for example, to a scholar? How should I know that such narrations are not true?
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said that فَاسْأَلُوا أَهْلَ الذِّكْرِ إِن كُنْتُمْ لَا تَعْلَمُونَ. Ask the people of the remembrance, okay, if you do not know. And of course, me and you as ordinary people, when we do not know such ideas, we should refer to the scholars, great scholars, and alhamdulillah, we are benefiting from the knowledge, great knowledge of all Shia scholars, and we benefit from their knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
You see that, let me share one narration, if you let me.
Yeah, please.
From Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, and these are actually main narration in this regard, and by these narrations we can understand other aspect of this story.
Right.
Imam said that فَوَاللَّهُ مَا أَقْبَبْتُهَا وَلَا أَكْرَحْتُهَا عَلَىٰ أَمْرٍ.
Hmm.
He said, I swear to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, I did not make Fatima angry and wrathful, and I did not force and impose anything upon her. You see how this honest, pure relationship between Fatima and Imam Ali. وَحَتَّى قَبَضَهَا اللَّهُ عَزَّ وَجَلَّ. Until the demise and martyrdom of Lady Fatima. And then he mentioned that وَلَا أَقْضَبَتْنِي وَلَا عَسَدْ لِي أَمْرًا.
So, but we have some narrations and hadith again in some sahih books that this great lady of Islam at the time of her death was angry, and she has had wrath with some of the well-known companions, that is, some even the caliphs. And it has been mentioned that when they refer to her to apologize from what they did to her, she did not accept them, and she actually refused to meet them at the beginning, but with Imam Ali alayhi salam's mediation, she accepted to meet them, but she didn't even look at them.
Yes.
So we have that even the kind of, because her love and her, let's say, friendship was a criteria for being a Muslim or being in the way, or because من أحبها فقد أحب الله ومن أبغضها فقد أبغض الله. So whoever loves her, it means that Allah is, it's as if he is loving Allah. Or whoever is making her angry, it is as if that he makes Allah angry from himself or herself. So we have such a hadith, and we have never heard and seen any hadith that there was sort of, let's say, anger between her and Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Yes, exactly. Talking about the wrath of Lady Fatima against some of the caliphs, it has been mentioned in the Hadith corpus. And of course, our discussion is not about that. But we are talking about the relationship, you know, honest and pure relationship of the Lady Fatima and Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. And he said that, وَلَا أَقْضَبَتْنِي وَلَا أَسَدْ لِي أَمْرًا. Never Fatima caused any trouble for me, and he never disobeyed me. وَلَقَدْ كُنْتُ أَنْدُرُ إِلَيْهَا فَتَنْكَشِفُ أَنِّ الْهُمُومَ وَالْأَحْزَانِ. I was looking at her, and she was, you know, causing all troubles and, you know, sorrow to be away from me by looking at her. You see, when you look at such a narration from Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, and when you look at this honest, pure, friendly relationship between them, how such a lies could be attributed to the, you know, Lady Fatima and Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
We need to see the root of such, let's say, rumors in the kind of anger and wrath that she had towards some other companions, because it can be a cue for those who are seeking for the truth in the history of the dawn of Islam, that is the beginning of the Islam.
Right. And let me add one point if you have time.
Yes, please.
They ask her about Lady Fatima, about Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, and she said that khayru ba'd, it is a best husband that you can imagine. The best husband possible that you can imagine is Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. You see, by these narrations of Imam Ali himself and Lady Fatima, peace and blessing of Allah be upon them all, how, you know, such a lies could be attributed to the Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam.
Once again, I want to back to the first question that I asked from you, Sheikhna. What can be the root of, or the roots of such, let's say, issues which are being mentioned sometimes in the history, in parts of history, or in the language of narrations from some books that they want to actually pretend that there was a sort of, let's say, lack of a good relationship between Lady Fatima salam and Imam Ali alayhi salam, while we know that their relationship was a purified one that actually everyone can confess from all the Islamic denominations, that they had a sort of, let's say, spiritual relationship, that even at the night of their marriage, they started worship Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for hours and hours. So how can we actually find the roots of these, let's say, rumors in the history, and to trace them to see what is the reality behind these rumors?
Actually, we can guess some reasons and philosophy behind such rumors. One of them, as I said, is a hatred toward Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, and another one is it has maybe some political reason behind that. Some people, they want to support the, for example, the government of Muawiyah, and of course some of the caliphate system, and they wanted to support such a, you know, system, and because of that they created and make up some, you know, lies against the personality of Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. And of course, maybe it has some other agenda behind that. We are not aware about that. But as I said, we should have a scholarly analysis to such a narration. It does not mean this narration has been mentioned in Sahih Bukhari. Of course, with all respect to the Sunni brothers and sisters, when the narration has been mentioned in one of the Sahah of the Ahl-Sunnah, it does not mean that that narration does not have any problem.
Right.
We should have, with all due respect to them, of course, we should have this scholarly analysis to the narrations, of course, as we have this analysis to the Shia.